The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan. It's International Women's Day, and our guest today, Ivy Josiah, women's rights activist and former executive director of Women's Aid Organization, and Hani Tan, a human rights lawyer and a regular on BFM 89.9. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I don't know if the greeting ought to be Happy International Women's Day. Is that the appropriate thing?
It's a bit of a mouthful, right?
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Happy IWD, everybody.
Oh, happy IWD.
Happy Women's Day.
Happy Women's Day. Now, there is a global conversation on women's rights, on women's lives. How do you situate this global conversation? Are there many conversations? The media, you know, if you're just looking today and you scan things, there's Belgium's new sexism law. Somebody has just been, charged on that. France is going ahead with pushing the gender pay gap issue and fining firms. So that seems to be what the global media is focusing on. How do you see it? And I want to begin with you, Ivy. How do you see our Malaysia and the conversations happening here in relation to this larger global conversation?
Right. I mean, certainly there seems to be an energized or re-energizing of the women's movement, you know, especially since the Me Too movement has certainly, you know, accelerated the pace. I think what's happening in Malaysia is in keeping with the global movement. I think the women's groups here have not let up at all, but they're using the global energy to then push for change here. In fact, the International Women's Day, one of the hashtags is Press for Change. There is definitely a relationship between what's happening in the region. In the region, definitely sexual harassment, violence against women has been talked about. And in Malaysia, it may not be that public, but certainly over the past 1 month, because we just came back from a CEDAW review from Geneva, there has been, you know, an energy around change.
Hani, on the question of CEDAW and the question of policy, I know that, Ivy, you work in, when you worked at a Women's Aid Organization, you had the shelters that did directly with the needs of women in crisis. But you also, through WA, worked on policy matters.
A lot,
important, when you weigh up, Hani, the balance of things, policy versus direct involvement in women in crisis, for instance?
Well, good morning, everyone, firstly. It's always important to have policies and laws because they set the standards of what is acceptable behaviour. But the bigger challenge is actually changing people's mindset, especially on gender stereotypes. Because gender stereotyping discriminates against women in the sense that if you fall outside this parameter of how they think women should be, you know, nurturing, loving, soft-spoken, innocent, unknowing, and if you are like ambitious, intelligent, you know, argumentative, that those are very so-called unfeminine sort of characteristics. And when you fall out of that, they think, oh, not very womanly, you know, and do we want this sort of person who's representing us, and what's the image, you know? So that's problematic because then you get discriminated either in terms of equal pay, or if you get discriminated against moving up the corporate ladder. So when that happens, then you don't enjoy the equal rights with men in terms of equal pay for work of equal value.
Precisely. Now, okay, if we look at the question of our progress, right? Have we done more and achieved more in terms of things like legislation and
Absolutely,
law?
Yeah.
And actually not done so well in terms of issues of culture, in terms of perceptions, in terms of relationship between men and women? Have we stepped back on that score?
Yes, absolutely. See, even though we have signed to an international treaty, Article 5 of CEDAW says precisely that the state, the government, must change culture, prejudices, social practices that contribute towards discrimination.
But can the state do that? Is the state in
fact... It has a clear obligation to change culture.
But how does the state do that? We're talking about families. We're talking about religious institutions. We're talking about a whole range of non-state frameworks in which people's real lives are, which perhaps shape their attitudes much more powerfully.
Let me give you a very precise example. Okay, sorry to interrupt, Shara, but I'm quite excited about this. So, for instance, I keep keeping this. Legislation is important. So, the Domestic Violence Act, you know, took about 11 years to get it implemented,
and 2 years to be enforced.
Yeah,
after
so 1990, 9 years, and then another 2 more years. Now, what happened was the year that it was passed, it was implemented, which was 1996. The very next year, there was a 200% increase in reports on domestic violence. So what has the state done? The state has introduced a legislation that criminalizes domestic violence. The state has also said that we do not tolerate domestic violence. Now, there's a huge cultural shift here. Immediately, women are saying, oh, right, I finally know that I can go to the police station and complain and make it and seek protection. So there is then the cultural shift.
But have our police force stepped up to the plate? Have our religious institutions, when dealing with, say, you know, when clerics have to deal and counsel
the big problem,
couples, do they say, take the legal route? Or do they say, no, you must reconcile, the family is more important, and women have to suffer in silence?
No, the problem is because there is no cohesive plan. That is the big problem. And there is no cohesive plan because there's no political will. In fact, the government actually admitted that in their CEDAW report when they replied to the CEDAW committee and said that, you know, gender mainstreaming is not an issue. It's not something that the government sees as an important issue, right? And they think that only the Women's Ministry is responsible to do gender mainstreaming. So another example I would say is that if you have a policy and you can implement it, everybody will start having to do something, you know. Like, say, for example, I think this morning you were talking about how in England now they're required to give monthly reports on the pay gap. See, so that is a policy, right? So then you force the private actors to do something. So in Malaysia, I mean, just going back a bit to the question about law and policies. In fact, in Malaysia, we don't really have a CEDAW-compliant legal framework. So we have it in bits and pieces, which is very unsatisfactory. Everybody thinks, hey, what's the problem, honey? You know, you got Article 8.2, you know, you cannot discriminate on grounds of gender. I'm like, so what? You know, because the big problem there is, private actors, that means non-state actors like companies and all that, are not held responsible for gender discrimination. The classic example would be Beatriz Fernandez, when it was held that, you know, it was not unlawful to dismiss her because she was pregnant. And you think, oh, they want 80s, never mind. Air Asia case, just a few years ago, same thing. She got pregnant, she got fired, and that was held to be not unlawful.
Okay, Ivy, I want to ask you this. You've worked with people in government. So we talk about government lacking, and you still do. You know, there's a lack of political will. But you also work with very powerful women in government. You have over the years. How do you make a sense of the so-called lack of political will? Or is it something that's kind of uneven? You have will in some ministries, you have people pushing. What's the situation like?
It's very uneven. So first of all, the Ministry of Women, right? You look at the journey of the Ministry of Women. It began as a little department, a secretariat, and then it became Ministry of Women around 2002. And then very soon it became Ministry of Women, Family, Community Development. You see how it's been diluted. So the fact that they think that this ministry has to look after old people, disabled, all the very important constituencies, but they've diluted the issue of women.
And why so? Why do they have done that?
Again, this is the culture. The culture of the law and the culture of policy is that there is still that belief that, come on, Ivy, we are still, after all, secondary. You know, we are secondary to men. You know, even in their personal positions, there's always this sort of, you know, they're all trained in waiting. We'll just wait. We'll just let the men decide. The ministry is seen as one of the, I think the ministry is not given the kind of respect it deserves. So, for instance, they have focal points in every ministry, right? And the focal points don't come and, you know, and they don't come and report.
Okay, honey, okay, and I'm going to come back to you, Ivy. But, honey, the question of these cultural attitudes, powerful women in government saying, we take a secondary role, we have to wait for the men. Now, where is that coming from? Is that coming from legislation? Is it coming from attitude, cultural norms,
yes,
religious notions? And how do you engage with that, honey?
Well, definitely it comes from your cultural and customary practices. So what Ivy was saying just now is a very gender stereotype role for women. That's why they lump women, family and community development together. In fact, one of the CEDAW committee members said that it was worrisome for her that they always couple women and children together. I mean, children's rights deserve separate attention. So in terms of what government can do, I would say have a clear and cohesive policy and start implementing it. You know, because if you don't even have a clear policy, you're just going to go haywire. You know, if you don't have like a framework within which to hang your actions, it's a problem.
Ivy,
yes.
Do we live on different planets in Malaysia? That there are those who very clearly see that when men and women ought to be equal, and those who say for religious reasons, I'm talking about all religious traditions, that men and women are different. I mean, some are from Venus, men are from Mars.
Religion and culture has been used to justify. It's been used to justify our position, and you know there is a growing, you know, painfully I have to say, there's been a growing acceptance that women have to take second place. You know, certainly there's been more influence on religion, so that the women's ministry and you know and people in general are in the cabinet too, they tend to defer to the religious authorities. Every policy that they want to introduce have to be referred to the religious authorities. And unfortunately, the religious authorities take the worst interpretations. You know, they are not looking at progressive interpretations. And more than anything else...
Progressive interpretations of their own religious traditions.
Of their own religious traditions. And that's the problem. And that's been... It's growing. We can see that there's not that kind of resistance anymore. They are not...
I'm speaking to Ivy Josiah, women's rights activist and former executive director of Women's Aid Organization. Hani Tan, a human rights lawyer. This is International Women's Day. We'll be back with a look at the women's movement in Malaysia. Stay with us. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, if you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Ivy Josiah, women's rights activist and former executive director of Women's Aid Organization. Hani Tan, a human rights lawyer. It is International Women's Day. We've been talking about the push and pull. Legislation very important as a framework, but culture also kind of the bed. And we ended with you, Ivy, just now talking about religious interpretations that are in fact shaping not just the lives of ordinary people, but also the mind set of our political leaders. You said they defer to religious authorities. So how do you deal with that? Especially when often feminism and the women's movement is framed as a liberal, Western, secular construct.
Absolutely not. It's definitely, it is liberal, it's freeing, but it's not Western and secular. I think women's groups all over the world now are understanding that we need to look at the Bible or look at the Quran. You know, some feminists, of course, do not want to do that. But whatever it is, religion is very important to women. And, you know, and lo and behold, the religious interpretations and religion itself does offer, you know, justice. It does offer interpretations that are very affirming and freeing. So, for instance, all of us on a private matter, you know, let's say we go to policy discussions, they'll all agree, of course, we shouldn't have child marriage. You know, we should remove it from the books. Why is it that we're still allowing for the state, these are state religious laws where, you know, a child can get married when she's 12, 13, 14, 15. Why can't they just change it? It's very simple. It's, again, the hesitation is that this is going to offend religious authorities.
Now, honey, the question of this, you know, it seems that in many ways, as a lawyer and working in, say, legislative change and you, Ivy, as well, in policy, that's the easiest stuff in the world.
Because, no, it's not. Disabuse you of that.
Okay. You do
that's
that.
That's a good
do
example
that.
Of how, you know, the religion, the religious authorities have more say. They're afraid to anger the authorities.
Okay, so what about engagement? Hani, I'll come to you. What about engagement with the religious authorities? What about the engagement with women who have positions in religious settings, that the preachers that are out there in all the religious traditions? Is there engagement with them? If they're going to be the stumbling block to legislative change, has there been engagement with them?
Well, we want to. I think the big problem here is they don't want to discuss with us, primarily because they feel that we are not qualified. So the biggest thing that they always throw in your face whenever you want to talk about religion is, are you qualified? What kind of qualifications do you have to discuss religion? But the problem here is that, I'll just say it, you know, Islam and the interpretations of Islam has seeped into areas which are now common to everybody. So every, you know, in the beginning they'll say, oh, don't worry, you know, matters of Islam will only pertain to, you know, people who profess the religion of Islam. That's obviously not true now, because that mindset, like Ivy had said earlier on, has seeped into policies and they're being implemented. So say, for example, if you want to queue and make payment in Kelantan, you know, men and women have to be separate. Whether you're Chinese, Indian, whatever it is, you just have to be separate. But and one more thing that I wanted to say about this attack against being liberals. I just want to remind everyone that in the preamble to the Rukun Negara, they talk about taking a liberal approach to us being Malaysians and living in Malaysia. So that people always refer to the Rukun Negara, you also have to look at the preamble, because actually that sets the stage for the five principles that come later on.
Well, Ivy, you know, people will say, well, the Rukun Negara might be what it is, but times have changed.
That's right.
And people can now make demands on the way the Constitution is interpreted.
Right.
And it might be a much more religious and conservative interpretation.
Definitely the conservative groups have adopted all our strategies. They are organizing themselves, they're writing memorandums, and they're also lobbying very hard.
And using
human rights language. I mean, again, I can go back to the examples where this is where I believe the state, specifically the cabinet, a cabinet that's made up of 32 to 34 ministers, of which only three are women, okay? So you have a cabinet that can actually set the standard. You see, even with domestic violence, we were told all those years when we were lobbying, this is against Islam. Islam recognizes that some little bit of discipline, a little bit of beating, it's okay. But we stood our ground. We said, no, we want to include all women. In fact, we were told, go away and have an act only for non-Muslim women. But we said, no, all women are affected by domestic violence. And the parliament took a stand and said, yes, we'll include all women. Now, where is that political will? Where has it gone to?
Okay, Ivy, I want to ask you this. You talk about, you know, only three women in cabinet, in a cabinet of about 30 people. Now, if we had more women in cabinet, would they bring something different to the table? Or would they be, as politicians are, you know, concerned about their voter base, about the conservative lobby in this country?
I think numbers are important, but I think when you have other women, more women in a committee, in a group, then there is that sort of sense of comradeship. There's a sense that perhaps, you know, that they can actually sort of, in a sense, gang up and stand together. I think having more women in any kind of committee, whether it's the cabinet or in parliament, does allow for more space and a sense that, you know, we're in this together. So it has worked elsewhere.
Okay. You know? Now, we have a tweet from Amiral Malik. He says, there's no strong argument about the permissibility of child marriage in Islam. That's his feelings. Now, we have all the problems. We laid out some of the problems. So let's talk perhaps today about some of the gains. And, you know, when you look at Malaysia, especially in a comparative perspective, what are the kind of gains that we made and how much better are we than others? Hani, I'll begin with you.
I think to begin this sort of conversation, sadly, in Malaysia, you really have to divide it between Muslim women and non-Muslim women. Because I would say for non-Muslim women, we have made actually quite tremendous strides in terms of having equality with men. So besides the Article 8.2 amendment, we've also amended the Guardianship of Infants Act so that now men and women, mothers and fathers, are equal guardians of their children. Previously, it was the fathers who were guardians. I think the other important one is the Distribution Act. So in the past, if the wife died, the husband would inherit all of her property. So now if the wife dies, then they have, I'm sorry, die intestate, that means without a will, the division now is equal. So they take into account children, parents, you know. So we have moved forward in that sense. But unfortunately for Muslim women, their rights have actually regressed. So if you just take, for example, the CEDAW review that came up recently, 12 years ago, which is when we had our last review, there was no fatwa on female genital mutilation, FGM. There was no whipping of Muslim women when they commit a criminal offence. Since our first review and moving into the one that we just completed, now you have a fatwa to say that FGM is wajib, and Now you have whipping of Muslim women.
Wajib means obligatory.
It's obligatory, yeah, correct. Obligatory. You know? So in that sense, that's regression. The other thing also is about, in terms of polygamy, right? For Muslim women and men, in the past, men can only marry their second and subsequent wives if it is just and necessary. But then amendments were put in to say it can be just or necessary. And there's a huge thing, you know, and I think Sisters in Islam have actually done excellent research on polygamy and its effects on the children and the wives.
I mean, Ivy, I know you can't speak on behalf of Sisters in Islam, but Sisters in Islam is a very important voice in these debates. Why do you think, I mean, just as women as a whole, I mean, whether you're Muslim or not Muslim, why do you see this differential in terms of progress? Progress in for some women and regression for others?
I think it's to do with the fact that, you know, in the Islamic world, and yes, I cannot speak on behalf of Sisters in Islam or Islam, but I think all our work has been evidence-based, so I'm just referring to the evidence that's out there. First of all, women are not seen as messengers of any religion. I mean, the Catholic Church too, for that matter, or even in Hinduism, when women come up and speak about religion, they're seen as, you don't know any better. So there is, again, goes back to the attitude and culture. So yes, you know, it is to do with the fact that the men are still the leaders, the decision makers are still afraid to make that position because they think that if they indeed go against populist notions of what a woman should be, then they're going to lose the vote. It's as simple as that. We're going to anger the Muslim voters. And for me, it goes back to the fact that groups like Sisters in Islam, and it's not only Sisters in Islam, that's Ikram, there are many other progressive groups made up of men and women. If they are allowed to go on national TV, on radio, to debate about this, I mean, for me, all I'm asking for is information to everyone so that they can actually choose for themselves what interpretation they want. They're not even allowed to do that. There's only one narrative that's out there to say, this is how we should look at women.
It's fascinating. You mentioned voters because you think that with the enfranchisement of women, that women will be voting for their self-interest minimally, right? And that would be to protect their rights to and perhaps even extend it. Honey, do you think that's not happening? Of women not seeing their vote as a tool to extend their rights?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert in this, but I imagine most people, when it comes to voting, will vote on economic issues. So I think the things that affect them in terms of their legal rights is of a secondary nature because you need survival first. But can I just get back to what Ivy was saying just now about diverse views? And because of the way in which the government controls the mainstream media, the fact that you don't hear diverse views was very sadly, you know, obvious during the CEDAW review when our Malaysian delegation people were actually giving answers. And their answers were so outrageous and outdated. And they don't even know it because they never had that kind of, you know, opposing views to theirs and how to deal with it. They didn't know how to answer questions. I think they were quite in shock, you know, when hard questions were asked and they didn't know how to answer.
Ivy, I mean, can anybody be naive about the global conversation? I mean, whether you're in the Malaysian bureaucracy or you're outside of it, there's the internet. There is, in fact, no lack of resources. Yes, maybe RTM is shut off to some diversity. I'm putting out there as speculation. But but there's the internet. I mean, there are all kinds of sources today.
But not everybody has access to internet, you know. And I think we need to put these ideas out in popular media in terms of national television, national radio. Yeah, I'm always a bit, you know, confused about this too. Why are we still, you know, I always keep saying that we Malaysian women are being trained in waiting. Let's wait. It's not the right time. Why isn't there an outrage? And maybe that's a reflection on the women's movement itself, you know. Perhaps we haven't gone out enough, and I think we haven't gone out enough to, we tend to speak among ourselves, we tend to speak in English, we do not go out to, you know, women outside of Klang Valley. We have very huge voices in terms of policy change and legislation. But when it comes to a movement building, no. I think there is, that when we have an issue, you know, let's say something outrageous happens. Let's say a child gets married at the age of 12. There isn't an outrage out there because that's to do with, and I think in reflecting on my work and our work, I believe, I think we need to, women's groups have to go out, speak in Malay and spread the news. We need to create a movement.
I've been speaking to Ivy Josiah, women's rights activist and former executive director of Women's Aid Organization. Hani Tan, human rights lawyer. This is International Women's Day. We'll be back with a look at what we must do. Stay with us. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, who just joined us. This is still the Breakfast Grill, and our guest, Ivy Josiah, women's rights activist, former executive director of Women's Aid Organization. Hani Tan, a human rights lawyer. Actually, we've had quite a few tweets and WhatsApp messages coming in. We had a tweet from Azrin Rahman. It says, I think it's only fair if there is a guest who can speak on behalf of Muslim women if you want to discuss the question of Muslim rights. Also, a WhatsApp from a doctor who said he she was shocked to be informed by lawyers at a panel that there's no such thing as marital rape, but there's no criminalization of marital rape in Malaysia. All these are very important questions, but can we focus, I mean, for the last remaining minutes that we have, I want to begin with Ivy, the question of the women's movement. You said earlier that, you know, that in some sense it's quite elitist, it's quite Klang Valley based, it's about a particular, it's almost class bound in many ways. But in terms of women's voices politically in the 20th century, women involved in the anti-colonial movement, in political parties, women's wings are very
looking back at those days and goes, what has happened to those days where they were so vocal?
Where did that energy go?
At some point, the political structures, so if you look at all the political structures of any political party, it's all led by men, right? And so, therefore, I think at some point, the women sort of gave up and gave all that leadership and all the decision making to men. Even to run, you have to make sure that the president of your party approves it. Usually the president of the party is always a man. So I think at some point we just gave up, thinking that the men can make decisions for us. And that's why I think, in a sense, I feel that I look back at my 30 years of my work and I think I have failed here or we have failed here. We need to get women angry again. But angry in a way to claim the rights and to voice their disappointment. Because almost every woman I meet, whether it's in the supermarket, whether it's in the market, you know, in a local market or in a bank, they will tell you stories about how they have been discriminated or they have a relative or a dear friend who's been discriminated. There's a lot of resentment and anger out there. How do we channel this so that it becomes a voting bloc? How do we channel it so that it becomes a bloc that says, enough? You know, we want to inherit equally. We want to be able to go to court and be able to divorce without having to wait for years for my husband to turn up in court. So that is where I think, you know, we need to just re-energize and to create the movements. I don't want to depend on leaders anymore. I want people and women power.
Hani, when you did start doing this work in human rights and women's rights, did you think you were joining a movement? And if so, where do you think that movement has gone?
Oh, when I started getting involved, it was actually a very narrow issue of me being a lawyer trying to, you know, assist women in divorces and cases of domestic violence. So it was very narrow. But as I started doing more of that and going to court, then I realized, hey, you know what? This law thing is not working, lah. You have to do something else, you know. So then I looked at policy. So I went into legislative reform and policy reform. And then you realize, hey, you know what? That's also not the way to fix it, because ultimately you have to fix the way people view and value women. So that's the bigger change. Mm. That, yes, it is part of us as well. But if the government doesn't set an agenda and stick to it, fund it, resource it, you know.
Governments should fund this agenda. But Ivy, you just say you don't want to rely on leaders. You want this to be grassroots. I mean, how do you deal with an assertion like Hani just made that we have to wait now for government to fund it?
No, that's not what I said. I think all I'm saying is that when we go out there and start spreading the message, you know, do not, you know, deny us that right. Do not keep. For instance, we were having a huge, big, foray into outside of Klang Valley to talk about freedom of religion, to talk about polygamy, to talk about, you know, rights within the family. And almost immediately, the government said, "No, let's not talk about all of that. Please stop these forums." Right. So we just want government to leave us alone for us to go out there and work on the grassroots level and not keep brandishing us as secular, Western, and so on.
Hani, do you see that happening? Is there pressure from government to be silent on these issues? I mean, are they pressuring women's groups to be silent?
I don't think they're pressuring women's groups to be silent, but I think they're not enabling. So I just want to go back to, you know, the perceived differences between Ivy's and my answers, which is not true. All I'm saying is that we need a multi-pronged approach.
Yeah.
So you do need the government funding, and that's absolutely essential, and the government commitment. So to go back to the session earlier on when you're talking about, hey, now you're the internet, go long lah. But why should we? Why should we go and look? Shouldn't it be put there out there as a message that people should know? Yesterday, we were at a talk by a High Court judge from Australia, and she said one of the things that private sector did was, you know, when you go and take money out from the ATM. So before you move on to your account number, something, there is a statement: domestic violence is wrong. So do you see what I mean? You should not go out there and look for things because, you know, you might not even be aware that what you're doing is wrong. But if there is messaging in the mainstream media that certain things are wrong, gender discrimination is wrong, violence against women is wrong, then I think the grassroots will realize, hey, you know what? That's true, lah. I have to do something about this.
Okay, so we come back to the question of agency and who takes charge, who makes the initiative. Ivy, you've worked with women's and women's movement for a long time now. Do you see generational differences? Are you hopeful that the younger generation is much more attuned to these
issues?
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't want to be that kind of an elder feminist who's going to say, oh, look at these women. Why are they so, you know, they have such short attention spans. No, I actually think there's certainly an energy. In fact, this Saturday there's going to be a women's march organized by young women. I think they have different issues at hand, but the only thing I always, you know, feel that there is a kind of a gap is that there's no real appreciation that we have gained a lot. You know, we keep forgetting that actually we have gained quite a lot of wins, especially the highest law in the country recognizes that there is gender equality. For young women to, or new women, or new activists to understand that there has been a history of gains. I do agree that the state has a great obligation. They should be funding us. In fact, in Singapore, 98% of the budgets for women's groups and civil society comes from government. They should be funding us. But I'm also saying, yeah, enabling is a good word. Leave us alone to do our work and not brandish us as being troublemakers.
Oh, but give us some money as well.
I'm always... The money is welcome without conditions.
All media space.
Media space.
Okay, just very quickly, quick statement, Hani, your wishes for International Women's Day. Well, what is it that you'd like to see achieved in the next 5 years?
For Malaysia, please have a CEDAW compliant legal framework. That's so important. Article 8.2, No Fadila's case is not enough. You need more.
Ivy, your message on International Women's Day.
Is that you can claim your right. You have a right. You have rights. We have made gains and those rights are yours. Claim it. My other wish is that I would love to see Sisters in Islam on national radio and television.
Okay, that was Ivy Josiah, women's rights activist and former executive director of Women's Aid Organization, and Hani Tan, a human rights lawyer. I'm Sharad Kutin. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.